From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After years of bit parts, actor Samuel Jackson's getting noticed. He plays a crack addict in Spike Lee's new movie, Jungle Fever. We'll meet him on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, writer Howard Rheingold tells us about his journey into the computer world of virtual reality. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Adventures of Amos and Andy, a new book that looks at the old comedy series and the controversy around it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There are reports from the United Nations of fighting between Iraqi troops and Kurds in northern Iraq. Jonathan Rugman filed this report for the BBC from Ankara, Turkey.
A spokesman for the Kurdistan Front, the coalition of Kurdish leaders based in northern Iraq, said that the troubles started in Erbil, one of the largest cities in Iraqi Kurdistan, which he said had been bombarded by Iraqi artillery throughout Thursday night. Two people who were reportedly part of a demonstration demanding more food and medicine were killed by Iraqi security forces firing from the roof of the town hall. An American military spokesman at the Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey said that the reports of violence were still being evaluated. "We have to see if there is a requirement to do anything," the spokesman said. He wouldn't speculate on whether the Rapid Reaction Force based in southern Turkey could respond to events outside the Allied safe haven zone in Iraq, but he said that the coalition was willing to respond to Iraqi actions that disturb the peace.
Jonathan Rugman reporting for the BBC. President Bush toured the Parthenon today and held further talks with Greek leaders in Athens. The president has offered to help mediate the conflict between Greece and Turkey over the island of Cyprus. The Greek prime minister told CNN today that he's asked President Bush to carry a message on Cyprus to Turkish President Turgut Özal. Prime Minister Konstantin Mitsotakis said that the conflict is close to a resolution. The American Federation of Teachers today rejected the Bush administration's insistence that parents be allowed to pick their children's schools from among public, private, and parochial institutions. But Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander told the group meeting in Washington this week that he and the president will fight for school choice because it's key to the nation's efforts to restructure schooling in America. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Education Secretary Lamar Alexander had to raise his voice above hisses and jeers from teachers when he ended his speech, saying that President Bush really did want to be the education president. And he angered a number of the union state leaders when he told them that competition between private and public schools for kids and tax dollars would be good for America.
"We do not believe it will hurt public education.
But what they have in private schools will not meet the needs of urban kids who aren't learning."
El Fondi from Pennsylvania reminded Alexander that the U.S. government's own research shows that even when private or parochial schools do accept disadvantaged children, they don't do noticeably better than public schools. School choice has become the most divisive issue among educators and politicians, overshadowing a consensus between the AFT and the Bush administration on things such as teaching standards and a national curriculum. School choice, if limited to public schools, says AFT President Al Shanker, may be worth debating later. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials were virtually unchanged, closing at 3,016. This is NPR. President Bush told the Senate today that it's not necessary to withdraw China's favorable trade status because he'll pressure the Chinese to adopt reforms. In a letter to Senator Max Baucus, the president said that he'll press the Chinese to stop unfair trading practices, human rights abuses, and sales of nuclear technology. The president maintained that withdrawing China's most favored nation status would cause serious harm to American interests. The Senate is expected to vote soon to put strict conditions on China's trade status next year. A key government panel today recommended that the Food and Drug Administration approve a new drug for AIDS, even though there's limited evidence to suggest that the drug, called DDI, is effective. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Right now, there's only one approved drug that slows the deadly progress of the AIDS virus, and that drug is AZT. but researchers have been working on similar compounds, and today an FDA drug review panel recommended that the agency approve one of these drugs, DDI, for people who don't respond well to AZT. This decision was made despite some misgivings about the safety and effectiveness of DDI, but the situation is dire because many people can't tolerate AZT, and even people who can find that the drug loses its effectiveness over time. Doctors hope that people with AIDS will live longer if they switch back and forth between the two drugs. DDI is already available on an experimental basis to people with AIDS who can't tolerate AZT, and if the FDA approves DDI as expected, manufacturer Bristol-Myers will be able to sell this product for profit. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Pentagon announced today that it's approved new arms sales to three Arab nations. The sales will include improvements in Egypt's Hawk anti-aircraft missile batteries, Morocco will get 20 used F-16 jet fighters, and the Persian Gulf state of Oman will buy more than 100 armored vehicles. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of this summer's more interesting movie performances is given by Samuel Jackson in Jungle Fever. The judges at the Cannes Film Festival liked Jackson's performance so much, they gave him a special award for Best Supporting Actor. Jackson is a former member of the Negro Ensemble Company and has had small roles in many films. This is Jackson's third film, directed by Spike Lee. You may remember him in Do the Right Thing as the radio DJ, Mr. Senior Love Daddy. But that cool character is very different from the out-of-control crack addict he plays in Jungle Fever. Jackson's character, Gator, is driven by his addiction. The only relationship he has left with his architect brother Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, and with his parents, played by Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, is pleading for money, which he knows they don't want to give him. So he tries to wear them down.
Oh, look at here. I'm a little light, though.
What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
You know, Don lost my address. Come on, hit me. Get some cash in my hand.
Gator does his dance when he asks anyone in his family for money. I asked Samuel Jackson the story behind this dance.
Well, actually, it's written in the script. That was Spike's idea, but I had to make up the dances. I judged by the way that I used to do things at my house. When my mom had her friends over, they would always call me in to do the new dances for them. And there would be older ladies sitting there watching you do the twist or the jerk or something.
Right.
Talking about how that would ruin their back if they did it.
That's right.
And it was a form of acceptance and performance that always garnered you praise and sometimes, you know, monetary recompense of some sort. You know, the ladies would give you quarters, dimes, whatever. And I'm sure that his mother did that very same thing. And they danced together. And he used the same tactics to entertain Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, when he was younger, too, to placate him and to get things out of him. So he uses that. It seems to be something he knows that works, and that's what he uses.
Do you know people who are crack addicted, or have you run into a lot of people on the street who are?
Yes, I have, and I do, and I did. All of those. I knew people who were addicted. I know people who are addicted, and I know people who are in recovery, and all of that. And in talking to them and talking to drug counselors, I discovered that using drugs usually cuts off your emotional growth. So I stopped Gator's emotional growth at about 16. So that when he reacts to things, he reacts to things as a 16-year-old. He wants what he wants when he wants it, kind of like a baby. And in doing that, it leads to a certain amount of vulnerability and not having a lot of coping skills in the world. So he reverts to that dance and begging rather than his own wiles.
Did your part in Jungle Fever give you a new understanding for our empathy with addicts?
Well, I always had that. I had a roommate who was a heroin addict in college. I've always had friends who were involved in drugs, drug trade, or in an addicted state. Even in my early, my formative years, I knew those people because I lived in a neighborhood in Tennessee that was kind of an alcoholic neighborhood. So it was the drug of the day was alcohol at that period. And we had a neighborhood drunk. There were lots of people in my neighborhood who sold bootleg liquor. So I saw people who were drunk all the time. That was another kind of addiction. And I had friends who drank from an early age throughout school. And then I knew people who did pills when it was time to do pills. And I guess during the 60s, I did all the things that all the people of my generation did during the 60s. So I had my own drug experiences at that time with marijuana and all the other things that passed through that era. And you just outgrow them. I did, but some people don't.
This is a very grim scene in a shooting gallery.
No, crack house.
In a crack house, I'm sorry.
Big
yeah.
difference.
Yeah, big difference. You're right. would you describe how the scene was set up? What it was like to shoot that? It's a very moody scene.
It was hot. It was hot and crowded in there. They had 500 extras that day. And they had people dressed in all kinds of professional attire and non-professional attire. There were doctors, lawyers, construction workers, nurses, store owners, mothers, fathers, teenagers, old people. There were all kinds of people in there just to depict the fact that crack is touching every strata of our society. And they pumped a lot of smoke in that room. They passed out a lot of stems. It was noisy in there. It was real, real hot. A lot of the extras, when you have that many extras on a set, all of them are trying to get into the camera shot, so it added to the chaos of the room because everybody wanted to be seen. So it was kind of like a crack house in that instance that there's a lot of activity. Most of the activity centered around those pipes because when you're in a situation like that, everybody's watching that pipe to make sure nobody gets a bigger hit than the next person. Everybody's trying to buy their own or hold on to some for themselves. And by the focal point of the scene being Holly and myself, sitting there on that mattress, everybody was trying to get close to us so they could get in that shot. So, you know, tension was pretty high in there. And I think it all paid off in the long run, just watching how the scene worked.
You know, everybody likes to do things for research. Did you feel like you should go to a crack house for research?
I felt like that, yeah. But I didn't have to. I felt like I should, but I really didn't have to. I've been in enough rooms with a lot of people getting high that it's all the same thing. The focus is always the drug and not the other people in there, you know. But the big difference being back in the 60s when everybody sat around and smoked marijuana, everybody got philosophical and had the answers to the problems of the world. When you're sitting around smoking crack or freebase cocaine, the whole focus is on that pipe and there is no conversation. It's not a friendly situation.
You've done several films with Spike Lee. How did you first start to work with him?
Well, School Days was my first Spike Lee film, was it? Yeah. Yeah, School Days was my first film. I was doing a soldier's play at the Negro Ensemble Company, and I was in the original company of that play. And Spike came by one day specifically to meet me because he knew a friend of mine, Monty Ross, his co-producer, and I worked together in college. And he came by to see me to tell me he had gone to Morehouse and he was going to make films. He was at NYU Film School. And he invited me to come down to watch some of the editing process of Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. That was his graduation film, his graduate project. And I went down, and we talked. He told me he was going to be a filmmaker, and he was going to do these films. And when he got ready to do them, he wanted to work with me. And I agreed to that. And sure enough, when he was able to hire union actors, he hired me.
Do you think that there's a difference between your portrayal of Gator the crack addict in Jungle Fever and how you'd be expected to play that role or what you'd think of playing that role if it was in, say, a crime series on TV or a big budget action film? Do you know what I mean? Where you wouldn't be the main character, you'd just be like a sidebar character who's like the crack addict.
Well, you only get a chance to see addictive behavior in those kinds of films. I had a chance in this film to take Gator out of the stereotypical addict role, where you either see him nodding or being totally crazy. So you had a chance to get into Gator the person, Gator the human being, and not just Gator the junkie, someone you don't care about at all or have no feelings about one way or another. Most of the time, those characters pass through films and they're props more than anything else. And since Spike was accused of not addressing the drug issue in any of his other films, I guess he attacked it with a vengeance this time and made sure that there were things going on.
Have you had to play more generic kind of roles in TV or in movies? You know.
Yeah. Well, I've been cast as black man. In Sea of Love, that was my name. No, it was Black Guy. In Sea of Love, that was the character name.
Is that what it said in the credits?
That's what it says in the credits, Black Guy. So I guess you could say I have. But I always try to make those characters memorable. People always remember me from the things that I do. It's back to my friends calling me King of the Cameos. Because I pass through films and kind of leave my impression. They always remember me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Samuel Jackson, and he stars as Gator, the crack addict, in the new film Jungle Fever. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Samuel Jackson is my guest. He stars as Gator in the film Jungle Fever. Now, didn't you spend a couple of years on TV as Bill Cosby's stand-in?
Not on TV, actually.
That's right.
I got to do
the set.
Yeah, on the set. We had a whole stand-in family, and we would go in and... Actually, we did. We were the junior Huxtables, I guess. And we would watch them rehearse the show right down the blocking, which is the way they move around the set. And on Wednesdays in the mornings, we would go in and actually do the whole show the way they did it so that they could plot out their camera shots and camera moves. And I wore Bill's clothes over my clothes because he's larger than I am so that the lights would be correct and they could get their color palette down. And I did that for 2.5 years, actually, and never got on the show. Well, actually, I did. Every time they show an exterior shot of people walking down the street outside their house, that's me and this other girl who was a stand-in, and we walked past each other. That's the only time I was ever on that show.
So as the stand-in for Cosby, you must have spent a lot of time sitting on the couch making jokes and being wise.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he spends the show.
Yeah. I imitated him quite well, so I did that for a while. And it was fun. It was kind of like taking a how to act on TV course for free and being paid at the same time.
So did this lead to any breaks? Did anybody offer to help you from the series?
Help me do what?
An on-camera gig.
No, that was always the thing that was kind of dangled to us to keep us coming back to do that job. You know, there's always a possibility you'll get on the show. I never worried about that, really. I was just there to do that while I wasn't doing anything else. And when it was time for me to do other things, I just went on and did them. I didn't wait for my big break on the Cosby Show because I really didn't realistically think that was going to happen, and it didn't. And I don't know anybody who's done that job who's ever actually gotten on the show. And I know people who've been there for a while, and I know people who've moved on and done other things who never got on there either. So it's kind of like the same thing. Actors always get stuff like that. People ask you to do off-Broadway shows and tell you, well, you know, they're actually thinking about moving this show. You know, everybody says that. You know, sure, the show's coming to Broadway in 1995, maybe. So you take your chances. I don't particularly believe anything until I sign a contract. I learned that early in the game. I sign a contract, I believe anything you say. Until then, it's all speculation.
Now, in Spike Lee's movie School Days, you mm-hmm. played a townie who was really hostile to the students
right.
who had arrived from out of town.
Leeds. He had a name. Leeds, L-E-E-D-S.
Thank you.
Yes.
But you yourself were not a townie. You were a college student and went went to...
What did you say, colored or college? What did you say?
College.
Oh, okay.
You were a college student.
I'm just kidding.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah, you were a colored student.
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Okay, but back to your question. Yeah. Yes, I was not a townie. No, I was not a townie. Yes, I went to Morehouse.
No. But yes.
Spike cast me in that role specifically because for a long time, my freshman year in college, this was before Spike's time, but I think Bill Nunn told him about it, the fellow who played Radio Raheem.
Yeah.
Well, Billy's a good friend of mine. But my freshman year at Morehouse, I actually hung out with the block boys. That was what we called them, not townies, but block boys. I actually hung out with them, and they didn't know that I went to college for about 6 months.
Oh, were you hiding that from them?
Not really, but I used to be with them when they were robbing college students and beating them up. And so they didn't really know I was one of them until they saw me at a dance one night and I had on some Morehouse gear or something. They're like, you go to Slim, you actually go to college? It's like, yeah. And it kind of changed their image of the Morehouse guy, and they didn't beat him up so often.
Oh, so you were really performing the role of Good Samaritan here.
That wasn't my purpose. Actually, what happened was when I got to college, my mom dropped me off there and I saw a basketball court up the street, and I played basketball a lot then. And I went up to the basketball court, and I bought a quart of beer. And I asked who was up next, and I played with them. And they just assumed that I had moved in the neighborhood because I was there every day and a long time, most of the day. And they just assumed I was one of them. And I hung out with them like I was.
So what kinds of things would they say about the college students?
Well, they were stuck up. They were what they called sadiddy. They actually thought, well, a lot of them did think they were better than, and we were taught that we were better than also by the administration of the school. We were told that we were in the top 10% of the black race who was going to lead everybody out of darkness into the light, and that Morehouse men were, at that time, something like 75% of all the doctors in America were Morehouse men, and Morehouse men were publishers, editors. They were the leaders of the race. So a lot of them really believed that, and they didn't speak to them. The guys would just say hello, and they wouldn't speak back. And that would be cause for a beating or another attitude to flare up, or they would run them back to campus, mainly because they wouldn't speak. They ignored those people who lived in the community. Like, they invaded these people's community and felt that they were there to run it, and that wasn't the truth.
Were you ever in the position where you were with your friends and they were robbing a college student who you happened to know?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Nothing. He looked at me, and before he could say anything, somebody hit him. And by that time, they took his stuff and we left. And as a result of that, I ended up in the dean's office because the guy did recognize me and he did report the robbery and did say that I was with him. And as a consequence of that, I was put on probation a few times because I refused to identify the people who did it.
Right. Did it ever bother you that they were doing that?
No.
Why not?
Because they were actually, well, 90% of the time, they were correct, and the person that they were taking the stuff from could afford to have it taken. And they were people with petty bourgeois ideas who needed a lesson like that in reality.
Speaking of petty bourgeois,
mm-hmm.
Now I understand that when you were in college that you were one of the people who held some of the trustees hostage.
Yeah.
So what were the issues?
The issues were that there weren't any student representatives on the trustee board. There weren't any community representatives because we were right in the middle of this community and these people should have a say in what kinds of things go on around them. There weren't enough black faculty members. We wanted more black studies because there weren't any at the school. We were trying to change some of the policies. And Charles Merrill, who was the head of the trustee board at that time, told them we were absolutely correct. But it was these quote-unquote men who were trying to make us these perfect Negroes who thought we were upsetting their apple cart. And they told us that we were the kinds of people that they never should have let in Morehouse in the first place. We were more or less an experiment in the kinds of people that they let in when my class came in. And we turned out to be just what they thought.
So did your radical politics go along with a radical sense of theater at the time?
Yeah. Well, no, I wasn't even doing theater then.
Oh.
Actually, I was just a student.
Oh, so you can't call this guerrilla theater then?
Well, that didn't happen until I came back to school in 71, second semester of 71. And that's when I started my theater major in earnest. And aside from the Morehouse Spelman Players, which was our proper theater in school where we did all our school productions, we had our own theater company, the Black Image Theater Company. That was our Hate Whitey Revolutionary Theater. But we did all those kinds of revolutionary poems and skits about the supremacists. We had like a singing group that was like the Supremes, but we were called the Supremacists. And we sang racist tunes. And we did all those Die Nigger poems so black folk can take over, you know, New Nation poems. And people were paying us to do that stuff. We were traveling all over. We were going to Tulane and Florida State and all kinds of big white schools. And they were like, yes, yes, denigrate us, denigrate us. Yes, do it, do it. And we enjoyed it. It was great fun.
What led you out of the radical period, the radical theater period?
What led me out of it? I didn't have time to do it anymore. And then times changed. People became very apathetic. Mm-hmm. Everybody was out trying to make a buck, and nobody was real concerned. I mean, Black Power just died for some reason. I don't know what it was. I guess it was oversaturation or whatever. But when people stopped wearing afros and wearing dashikis and nationalism didn't become so fashionable, then that theater changed into more or less of a mainstream type of thing. The Black Image Theater started to do scripted plays that were still about, by for, and about Black people, but it wasn't that, you know, die whitey or hate whitey theater. It was more about the Black human condition.
This may sound like an odd question, but this summer has been like a terrific summer for young Black directors and actors.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, you know, that so many of these new directors are really pretty young, and a lot of the actors who they're casting are pretty young, too. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you think that there'll be room for actors who are, gosh, already in their 40s. You know what I mean?
Like me?
Yeah, right, in the newer movies. You know, it's like, it's really great, but,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. It's not vanity, but folks always say, it's hard to believe that I'm 42 years old. But I am, and I have a 42-year-old sensibility, but I also have that other sensibility, too, because I hang out with younger people. But this will give me a chance to do the kinds of things that I've never been able to do by being able to work with these younger directors. I'll be able to play a father who has a father's sensibilities because I am a father. And I'll be able to play somebody's mentor, possibly, because I haven't been able to do that. So I think I'll be able to work with these kids. And a lot of them I know.
Uh-huh.
And I've met most of them anyway. I met John Singleton when they had the premiere for Jungle Fever, and he expressed an interest in working with me, and I expressed one working with him. I know Bobby Townsend from when he was running around here being a stand-up comedian,
right,
and an actor before he became Bobby Townsend. So I know him. I know Spike. I know Kevin Hooks. I just worked with Kevin. I know so many of these directors, and I think that my work will speak for itself, and that if they really want a good actor to do something, then they'll ask me to do some of those things that 40-year-old people do in their films. They won't all be, I mean, they won't all be so teen-oriented that I won't be able to do anything. I'll be the teacher at the school, the principal, whatever. Who knows, you know? I'll do something.
Well, Sam Jackson, I wish you the best. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Samuel Jackson co-stars in Jungle Fever. He plays Gator, a crack addict. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At laboratories and research centers around the world, computer wizards are busy inventing a new technology called virtual reality. It has the potential to change everything from how doctors diagnose disease to how we fight wars to how we do business and how we watch TV. Coming up, we learn about this new computer-generated reality from someone who's experienced it and written a book about it, Howard Rheingold. The comedy series Amos and Andy was on the air for a quarter of a century, and for all that time, it was controversial. Now there's a new book on the social issues surrounding the program. Maureen Corrigan reviews The Adventures of Amos and Andy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the first major clashes in northern Iraq since Allied forces pulled out, there has been fighting between Kurdish forces and Iraqi troops. It's unclear the exact number of casualties, with some reports indicating several hundred people may have been killed and wounded. The two cities where the fighting occurred had not been in a security zone set up by Allied troops. But U.S. officials say that Baghdad had been warned before the pullout of a possible military response if it did not keep the peace. Iraq has conceded to the U.N. that it was attempting to build a supergun, a long-range cannon-type weapon capable of firing heavy projectiles that could destroy entire buildings. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports from New York.
Western intelligence officials have long known that Iraq was attempting to build a supergun, but this was the first time it was actually confirmed. The disclosure was made in a letter to the UN Special Commission in charge of disarming Iraq. The letter said Iraq had built components for two superguns, including a 172-foot, 350-caliber barrel and special tubing for a 1,000-caliber weapon. Iraq said it was testing the weapons at a site 90 miles north of Baghdad. Under the terms of the Gulf War ceasefire resolution, Iraq is required to turn over all of its weapons of mass destruction to UN authorities. In recent weeks, Security Council officials have accused Iraq of concealing part of its weapons program, especially its nuclear capability. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
President Bush has wrapped up a two-day visit to Greece, trying to calm concern there over a warmer relationship between the United States and Turkey. NPR's Richard Gonzalez, who is covering the president's trip, reports from Athens.
Mr. Bush came to Greece to assure the Greek government of his commitment to strengthening economic and security ties. He promised to deliver 18 F-4E aircraft to Greece by autumn and to send large numbers of tanks and artillery from existing NATO stocks. He also offered to do whatever he can to help resolve the conflict in Cyprus, which was invaded by Turkey in 1974. But Prime Minister Konstantin Mitsotakis, for two consecutive days, has indicated that he wants more from President Bush. Mitsotakis said the U.S. should do for Cyprus what it did for Kuwait. But the U.S. is unwilling to take such a step. Instead, Mr. Bush has expressed his support for U.N. efforts to arrange a peace between Turkish and Greek Cypriots. Tomorrow, the president arrives in Ankara, Turkey, for a two-day visit where he will thank Turkey's President Ergun Özal for his support in the Persian Gulf War. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Athens.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed unchanged at 3,016.32 on volume of some 187 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In Washington, Education Secretary Lamar Alexander was booed today by some members of the American Federation of Teachers when he said that President Bush genuinely wants to be the education president. After his speech, Alexander was questioned by teachers, mainly about plans by the Bush administration to allow parents to send their children to public, private, or religious schools at taxpayers' expense. One educator accused the Bush administration of taking the political way out in public education, and another said Mr. Bush was not putting his budget priorities into education. Latin American leaders meeting in Mexico have made progress toward free trade in their area. Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela are to drop trade barriers in January. The Central American nations have also made a start toward a common market. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from the summit meeting in Guadalajara.
South
American leaders have complained for years about unfair trading terms with the developed world and the need for Latin unity if the region is to compete. In the past, there's been a lot of talk and little joint action. Here at the first Latin summit to include Spain and Portugal, they've finally moved ahead. The six small nations of Central America arrived here from their own preparatory mini-summit, saying they've agreed to lift tariff barriers on a range of farm products as the first step to creating a common market of their own. They were quickly upstaged, however, by Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela, who signed a free trade pact here to take effect in January. Mexico is also negotiating free trade with the United States, which has called for a single market from Canada to the Southern Cone. In Guadalajara, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Officials of Japan, Britain, and the United States say that they will work more closely in the future in efforts to uncover securities fraud. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Whether or not you own a computer yourself, I think you'll be interested in hearing about a new development in computer technology that has the potential to change everything from cancer research to how we fight wars and how we entertain ourselves. It's called virtual reality, and it's a computer-generated, three-dimensional reality that could be as convincing as a hallucination. My guest, Howard Rheingold, is the author of the new book, Virtual Reality. He's also the editor of the Whole Earth Review. The technology of virtual reality is still in the experimental stages. Since I haven't experienced virtual reality, and I figure you probably haven't either, I'll let Rheingold explain what it is.
I like to talk about the experience of virtual reality before I talk about the technology, because I think everyone is familiar with the kind of experience that, well, you go to a movie theater, for example, to get. It's the experience of temporarily immersing yourself in an artificial world, in a fantasy world. I think if you go back to the original cave paintings that were done 40,000 years ago, or the paintings of the Renaissance, or photographs, motion pictures, even 3D motion pictures, there has been a continuing attempt by people to create a kind of fantasy world that people could really sense that they're inside that world. So virtual reality uses modern technologies, computer technology, a special kind of goggles that have little television sets in them, and a kind of wired glove to give you the feeling that you are inside an artificial world, a fantasy world.
So the goggles give you the 3D image. What does the wire glove do?
Well, when you're inside this world, you can look around and you can see what's above you. You can see what's below you. If there's a door in front of you, you can walk through that door and see what's in the next room. But besides being able to move around in it, if you have this glove on, the glove is connected to a computer, and you see a hand floating in space in that artificial world. And when you wiggle your fingers in the real world, you will see the fingers of that glove wiggle in the artificial world. And if there's a coffee cup in front of you in the artificial world, in the virtual world, and you reach your hands out, you will see that depiction of a hand reaching out. You could pick up that cup and look and see what's underneath it. Not only are you inside an artificial world that you can move around in, but because of this glove, you can actually manipulate it with your hands and see that manipulation.
Tell us about one of the most convincing experiences you had with virtual reality.
One of them that was the most interesting was very concrete, because I was inside a building that was designed in virtual reality. So there was a, just as you can create a computer model of a building that architects can use to make blueprints, they took a computer model of a building, these computer scientists at the University of North Carolina, and created a virtual model of it. Now, I was able to put on this head-mounted display with the little eye set that showed me a 3D world and stand on a treadmill. And I could walk down the hallways of this building, and it looked as if I was walking down the hallways of a real building. And I could turn a corner and see what was down that corner. I could go into a room and see what was in that room. The interesting thing about that experience was that the computer science building at the University of North Carolina is the building depicted in that model. And before they built that building, the computer science students there created this virtual model and walked through it to see how they would like it, and in fact decided that one of the walls was too close in and gave a cramped feeling, and they moved that wall. So that was one of the most interesting things, was to be inside this building as it was, after it was actually built, experiencing the model of the building.
What are some of the applications of this kind of amazing new 3D computer-generated process for science and medicine?
Okay, science really, I think, advances when somebody comes up with a way to extend human senses. I think a good comparison to how virtual reality can help scientists is the microscope and the telescope. The microscope extended biologists' senses into the world that was previously invisible because it was so tiny. If you think about it, modern medicine, antibiotics, were not possible before the microscope because nobody could tell the germs caused disease. Virtual reality can enable scientists to see into worlds that were previously very difficult to see into because they were either too complex, and of course computers are very good at modeling complex things, or because they were three-dimensional structures, and a kind of two-dimensional look through a microscope or a telescope or an X-ray machine is not quite enough. I watched some chemists using head-mounted displays and a force feedback, which gives them a way of actually feeling the virtual world, design a new anti-cancer molecule. The way anti-cancer medicines work have to do with the way molecules fit together. And they were trying to fit together a synthetic molecule with a molecule found on a tumor cell. And they did it by reaching out and grabbing models of the molecules and trying to fit them together like Tinker Toys or pieces of a 3D puzzle. And because what they were holding, kind of like a gripper, translated the molecular forces into physical forces, they could actually feel places where the molecules would fit together like a lock and key and therefore be an effective medicine. And this has proved to be a very useful design tool for pharmaceutical chemists.
Let's talk some more about the applications of virtual reality after we take a short break. My guest is Howard Rheingold, author of the new book, Virtual Reality. This is Fresh Air. Howard Rheingold is my guest. He's the editor of the Whole Earth Review and the author of the new book, Virtual Reality. Now, the military is often at the forefront of developing and using new technologies. Is the military using virtual reality?
Absolutely. The war in Iraq, there was a lot of virtual reality involved in the training for that war. I myself saw a tank simulator network when I was researching this book. Tank crews get inside little rooms that look exactly like the inside of a tank, and they are all plugged into a simulation of a battlefield. Now, although this is not in three dimensions, it's the kind of computer modeling that's involved in virtual reality. And in fact, these head-mounted displays, where you put the little television screens on your head, were developed for about 20 years by the Air Force for jet pilots to have effective displays where they could see radar and they could see through cloud cover. So the military has been using these to train people in combat situations for a long time. The other aspect of military research, I think, is the more frightening one, and one that I think the public ought to have a bit more discussion about. And that's what they call semi-autonomous weapons. When I was at the Naval Ocean Systems Center in Hawaii, which is a U.S. Marine Corps research facility, I saw a Humvee, a vehicle that, instead of having a driver, it had a robot driver, and it had a big spool of fiber optic cable that linked that robot to an operator with a head-mounted display who would be in a bunker a quarter mile away. And in the passenger seat was a 50-caliber machine gun. So you can imagine that people will be able to operate, they are, today able to operate deadly weapons that will roam around miles away and see through the robot's eyes and pull the trigger with their finger safely inside a bunker.
It's pretty remarkable.
It's pretty remarkable, and I think that you can make an argument that there's some real advantages to putting machines on battlefields instead of people. But I also think that there is one scary aspect of this, which is the person who is inside a bunker performing a simulation does not really know when they pull that trigger whether they are playing a video game or blowing up real people. And I think that that's the danger of semi-autonomous weapons. In fact, NATO held a conference on this possibility that in the wrong hands, people might, for example, take some trainees and tell them that they are in an exercise, but in fact switch the virtual weapons to real weapons, and while they think they're having real fun in a video game, they're blowing up real people 1,000 miles away.
What are some of your other concerns about the applications of virtual reality?
Well, one concern is we already live in a society in which the television set is on 6 or 7 hours a day. When your television set's on, at least you can see other people and you can see the real world. If you're in virtual reality, you can't see the real world. The danger of it being as addictive as television, I think, is a real concern when it does become an effective entertainment medium. And I'm concerned that this is coming at a time in which the natural world is being destroyed. So at the same time that we are reaching a point where our forests and our rivers are being replaced by artificial phenomena, people are given an opportunity to escape into a totally artificial world. I could foresee a worst-case future where billions of people become so fascinated by virtual worlds that by the time they take their head-mounted displays off, the whole world is paved over. Although I think that this is a very useful technology and I would love to see it developed for science and medicine, I do think we need to do what we didn't do when the television first came along, which is to try to establish some values about it. Do we really think it's going to be valuable for people to spend all day in a virtual reality?
Do you think a lot of us will have our first exposure to virtual reality through entertainment?
Yes. I think a low-level virtual reality is already available. There's the BattleTech Center in Chicago. People get in these little booths that have screens around them and pretend they are in a space war, and they spend good money at this. I think it's something like $7 an hour. Arcade games are probably going to be the first place most people have contact with this.
In science fiction, there is already a tradition of a computer-generated reality, a reality that doesn't exist in real life. It was just kind of created in the computer, and people kind of enter into this totally created 3D reality, and that reality is shared by people who have this computer program around the country or around the world. Is anything like that actually happening in real life, or is that just in science fiction?
There are people who have very serious plans to do this. When I was in Japan, I visited a research center that's spending about $10 million a year to create a way to use virtual reality as a communication medium. So you might imagine a future in which millions of people inside their homes are actually in their apartments, but seem to be walking down the street of a totally artificial city, interacting with one another, talking to one another, conducting business. So it may be that part of the future of the human race is going to take place in virtual reality, just as part of our communications now take place in the kind of virtual reality that exists when you're on the telephone.
What application are you most looking forward to that you'll be able to use and that will make your life more interesting?
I like that idea of it being a communication medium because, face it, humans evolved for millions of years being able to communicate face-to-face. And electronic communications enable us to conquer the barriers of space and time, But when you talk on the telephone, you can't see someone's body language. And you can't see the way they're moving their hands and their eyes. I think it would be great if we could have a kind of virtual meeting space where people could relate to one another. And of course, the fun thing about that is you don't have to look like the way you look. You could look like a movie star, or you could look like a lobster. You could create a representation of yourself, and others could create representations of themselves that would move along with them, but would look the way they wanted it to look.
Even better than plastic surgery for those who want it.
That's right. And then what's going to become important? Appearance is so important now.
Yeah.
If you can project whatever kind of appearance you want, what will become important might be the way you interact with people rather than the way you look. And that might be advantageous.
Howard Rheingold, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me here.
And Howard Rheingold is the author of the book Virtual Reality, and he's also the editor of the Whole Earth Review. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of news today, but I want to tell you especially about one particularly nice radio story we have. It's about the Nez Perce National Historic Trail along the border between Montana and Idaho. Alex Chadwick traveled along that trail for several days along with many of the Nez Perce Indians and people from the U.S. Forest Service, and we get to hear about his experiences. The story was recorded by Saraya Muhammad, an NPR technician. She rode along on horseback with the group and her digital tape recorder. Really beautiful radio sounds in the story.
What makes this such a good radio story?
You know, it puts me there in the mountains. I got to hear especially the horses neighing early in the morning and Indians singing. It's just really a pretty sound.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Say, Amos, this seems like Sunday.
It is Sunday. You see, Andy, we is on the radio now every Sunday on CBS for Rinso.
That's right. Rinso, the new Rinso with Solium, brings you the Amos and Andy Show.
Amos and Andy debuted in 1928, and for more than 25 years, it was one of the most beloved radio shows in America. Factory shifts were rescheduled so people could listen to the show, and hundreds of newborn twins, both black and white, were given the names Amos and Andy. But the show was also controversial. Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book about the Amos and Andy phenomenon by historian Melvin Patrick Eli.
If Amos and Andy simply manipulated racist stereotypes for laughs, why did prominent African Americans like Roy Wilkins and Duke Ellington praise the show in its early days? On the other hand, if it was a warm, respectful portrait of life in Harlem, why have the names Amos and Andy become as insulting as Sambo and Uncle Tom? Melvin Patrick Eli examines the ambiguous identity of the Amos and Andy show, and refreshingly, he finds that its fans and critics don't fall into the predictable categories. Instead, black and white audiences' responses to Amos and Andy were as complex as their responses to the issue of race itself. For instance, when the TV version of Amos and Andy debuted in 1951, the NAACP was holding its annual convention. The delegates voted to protest the show, but behind closed doors, some of these same delegates confessed they thought the show was realistic and funny. The theme music of the Amos and Andy show came from D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie, The Birth of a Nation, which glorified the Ku Klux Klan. And white racists certainly could find much to laugh at in Amos and Andy's shuffle and jive routines. Yet Eleanor Roosevelt and lawyer Samuel S. Leibowitz, the defender of the Scottsboro Boys, were also devoted fans of the show. The creators of Amos and Andy, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll, were white. But since they wanted to attract the largest audience possible, they pulled off a careful balancing act in their humor. Gosden played the sweet, hardworking Amos, and Correll the lazy, blowhard Andy. Both men had worked on the stage as black-faced comedians, and they brought aspects of the minstrel tradition into their radio show. When Amos and Andy moved to TV, black actors replaced Gosden and Correll. And as Eli recounts in a painfully funny anecdote, Gosden and Correll took it upon themselves to coach their replacements in how to play their black characters more convincingly. Because Amos and Andy took place in an all-African-American community, the black characters were unusually diversified. Granted, the character called Kingfish was a stereotypical con man, and his wife Sapphire was kind of a mammy figure. But Amos's girlfriend Ruby was dignified and attractive, and Ruby's father, Mr. Taylor, was rich and well-educated. Like the characters, the humor of Amos and Andy also reinforced and overturned racial stereotypes. Listen to this.
Andy, tell me one thing. Is you a Democrat or is you a Republican?
Well, I was a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
But I believe I have done switched over to the Republicans now.
Who is the man that is running against each other this year election time? Explain that to me.
Herbert Hoover, Vesuvius Al Smith.
Herbert Hoover, Vesuvius Al Smith, huh?
Yeah.
Another thing I'm gonna ask you. What is the difference between a Democrat and a Republican?
Well, one of them is a mule and the other one is an elephant. That's the way I get it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm going to be a Democrat or a Republican, you know it?
Well, what was your ancestors?
My aunt didn't have no sisters.
No, no, not your aunt's sisters, your ancestors. I mean, how did your old man vote?
Oh, my papa, you mean?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, papa used to always vote for the Democrat.
Well, then if I was in your place, I would vote for the Republican.
How come?
Because I ain't never knowed your old man to do nothing right in his life.
The fact that Amos and Andy are discussing politics makes this an unusual conversation for the time between two black characters. But precisely because black political activity threatened many white Americans, Amos and Andy's talk had to be reassuringly naive. Eli makes the ironic point that the very humanity of Amos and Andy made them seem real. And because people believe their characters, they also believe that their overwhelming ignorance and other stereotypical traits were characteristic of African Americans as a race. Eli's book, The Adventures of Amos and Andy, demonstrates once again that when questions of race arise in this country, the answers are rarely black and white.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Adventures of Amos and Andy by Melvin Patrick Eli. All of us at Fresh Air would like to thank our intern, Tracy Hildebrandt, for all her good work. She leaves us today. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philip Levine put in years at the factory before he left for his true calling, poetry. The factory was so close to hell, he's still writing poems about it. On the next Fresh Air, What Work Is, with award-winning poet Philip Levine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.